Martin Fletcher really knows Israel. He's our guest right now on Travel with Rick Steves. In his book, Walking Israel, Martin describes his discovery of another Israel, everyday Israel, when he took time off to meet the people while exploring the country's 100-mile coast by foot. Martin, what's your work situation now?
I resigned from NBC News a year ago in order to write more books, and I'm still working on contract with NBC.
Okay.
But I also saw the book as a sort of, you know, crossing the T on my time in Israel.
It is fascinating to think that what you mentioned a moment ago, that you feel like some of the most important reporting you've ever done was basically giving an intimate look at Israel that's not war-torn, but just the communities living along the coastline.
Yeah, I felt that we always gave a very partial view of Israel through focusing on the conflict, and I wanted to make some contribution to showing that, you know, it's a great place where actually 70% of the population live along the coastal plain, and we hardly ever mention them in news reports because we focus on the occupation, the settlements, and the conflict.
Martin, reading your book, Walking Israel, and knowing about your passion for not only reporting the news from hot spots, as you did for so many years, but just understanding a people, I was considering the work of Mort Rosenblum, another foreign correspondent, and he's written a couple of books recently, one of them, Escaping Plato's Cave, talking about the economic challenge of just the whole notion of foreign correspondence these days and how economic cutting back is actually making journalism a little less thorough from a foreign correspondent's point of view. What's your take on that?
Well, he's right. I mean, the economic considerations, and also, by the way, the declining American interest may be, in terms of the audience, in matters foreign. I mean, NBC News, for instance, in Israel, we used to have 17 staff people. Now we're down to 2. CBS is down from 17 to 1 freelance person working from home, and ABC went down to 1 person who's now gone to London. So right there with the 3 American networks, there's a dramatic collapse in the numbers of people covering the country. I'm just talking about Israel.
Wow.
And obviously there's a concurrent suffering in terms of the ability to really understand the country. You know, we send people in to report the news, but they can't possibly have the depth of someone, for instance, like me, who's been there for so long. And that's the same story worldwide.
So what are the consequences then from a consumer of news when you have all the networks cutting back so dramatically on the number of people they actually have in the field?
I think people are ill-served. They'll have less understanding and less, not only in terms of quantity, in terms of how many stories are there from overseas, and not only in network television, but also many, many newspapers have cut back. They've cut their bureaus. The bureaus that continue have fewer people. They rely more on local sources. But at the same time, there's a change in the information flow. We're beginning to rely more on local people using Facebook, Twitter, cell phones, different ways of conveying information. But, you know, our role has been as a sort of, you know, the educated gatekeeper, the analyst who puts things in context. And you, in theory anyway, would trust the reporter who's working for a network or a major newspaper to be telling you pretty closely to the truth. But if you're getting information from, say, inside Iran, from an Iranian with a cell phone, and then an Iranian Facebook group telling you what's going on, well, it may be great, and it may be just disinformation from the SAVAK, from the secret police. You don't know who's giving you that information. So I think for the consumer's point of view, it's very hard to know what the real source of information is and how reliable it is today. And I think that's a great threat to our understanding of the world.
So as a society, we're frankly cheaping out on international news coverage, and most people probably don't even realize it.
The question really is whether people care, because if they did care, then probably the networks and everybody else would change their economic model.
Now, I was thinking it might just be harsh economics. It's really expensive to pay for a good-looking anchor woman, and the money's got to come from somewhere. Why don't you just fire a few correspondents?
Well, I'm with you on that one.
I mean, it seems absurd what an anchor person gets and how they're cutting back. You lose 10 people in the field, or probably 50.
Yeah, you know, the salaries of the network anchor people, they range up to between $8 and $16 million a year per person for his salary.
Is that more than what you were receiving?
I mean, it's ludicrous. We could run an entire foreign network with just one man's salary.
But from a business point of view, they'll cut loose the entire foreign network in order to have the most convincing, eye-friendly anchor person.
Well, you know, that's American business. And I don't think we can really blame journalism or even journalist managers. You know, that's the American media is a commercial business, has become a commercial business.
Yep.
And that's how you make money. It's very unfortunate.
Okay, so what you're saying is news is entertainment.
I'm not saying that you did it, but I certainly would agree with you if you said it, to an extent. I wouldn't go all the way and say that, because there's a lot of very serious news coverage, but it's the entertainment part of it that really seems to grab the viewers and keep them.
I think it's a very dangerous trend, and I'm very concerned about it. And I'm thankful for the work that you've done and your commitment to helping us understand complicated issues in these far corners of our planet.
Yeah, thank you.
I'm Rick Steves. This is Travel with Rick Steves. We're joined by Martin Fletcher, who for 30 years has been a foreign correspondent working for NBC News. And his book is called Walking Israel, A Personal Search for the Soul of a Nation. Now, when you live in these communities as you hike and you connect with the locals, I understand Israel is quite a young population. What's the young generation's opinion of the military in that society? Because it's a huge part of the economy and people's lives is just the necessary military aspect of Israel.
Yeah, I did spend one chapter writing about the Israeli army, not from the point of view of what it did, the battles, the wars, but from the point of view of what's it like today for young Israelis, boys and girls, young men and women who need to go into the army. You know, Israel is one of the few Western countries where kids are still conscripted. Boys do 3 years, girls do 2 years. And I asked them, I wanted to analyze that question. What do they actually feel about it? Because Israel used to be a country fighting for its survival, and therefore it was easily understood why you had to go into the military. But today, Israel survived. Now it's more a matter of what kind of country it will be. And so to tell young people you've got to spend 3 years of your life in the army, if you're a boy, is increasingly a hard sell. The defense minister, Ehud Barak, said a year ago that the army's become the army of only half the nation, meaning that half the kids of army age actually don't do the army, either because they're Arabs or ultra-Orthodox or for other reasons. And so that's a very important issue.
If you're a conscientious objector or just a person that doesn't want to serve, how do you get out of military service in Israel where supposedly everybody is supposed to serve?
It used to be tough, and you used to get very stigmatized, and it would harm your future role in Israeli society.
Right.
Today, it's not so tough. You really don't get stigmatized, and it matters only in certain parts of Israeli life. So in other words, it's more accepted today to actually try to get out of the army, and many people do. Another issue is about 15% of soldiers leave the army before their 3 years is over. And in fact, in the book, in the chapter on this subject, I followed one young man who'd spent 18 months in the army. He was a medic, a commando. He'd been fighting in Gaza. And he just felt, I've had enough. And so he went to the psychologist and said, I want to leave the army. Then he went to another social worker, the psychiatrist, and persuaded them that he didn't need to be in the army. And the last question they asked was not to him, but they called his mother. They called the Jewish mother and said, do you want your son to leave the army? She said yes, and so the army said to the boy, you can leave the army. So it was a process that was fairly difficult, but ultimately he left the army. And the real point of my story following him in the book was that he lied throughout the entire process, and I thought he was going to end up in jail. But actually, he ended up out of the army as he wanted.
Wow. So I guess it's just a natural sort of development, as is the equivalent in the United States, as the Great Generation and the Pearl Harbor survivors pass away. We have less of a connection with that part of our history. And as the people who actually suffered through the Holocaust pass away, there's no living memory of that in a few more years. And you'll lose that sort of empathy and passion for that in Israel.
I think so. Another one of the chapters was about the Holocaust, Israel's attitudes towards the Holocaust survivors. And today, even in Israel, the Holocaust is a history lesson for young kids in, you know, 7, 8, 10, 12, 15 years old. It's just part of a history lesson, which sometimes they're interested in and sometimes they're not. It's a great challenge to keep the memory of that alive.
And probably very frustrating for the old people who remembered it, actually. Of course, the kibbutz movement is changing. It used to be a powerhouse in the social fabric of Israel. How is the idealism of kibbutzim changing?
Well, it's a thing of the past, actually, the idealism. The fact is that most kibbutzim went bankrupt or became close to bankruptcy. And in order to save themselves, to continue to exist, they privatized. So the old image we have of the kibbutzim, of this socialist ideology, and young men and women in short shorts and city hats dancing in the banana groves with their guns, you know, that's all a thing of the past. Today it's mostly factories. They sell their land to outsiders who come and live on the kibbutz. But on the other hand, they saved the kibbutz. The kibbutz was threatened with bankruptcy,
okay. And
I followed the story of one in particular. But nevertheless, today, they saved themselves by getting rid of all those things like kindergarten for everybody sharing the same clothes, you know, one car for the kibbutz,
right,
and making it a more privatized commercial capitalist enterprise, which today is very successful again. But is not really a kibbutz. It's a kibbutz in name only.
Who was it, Gorbachev, that went down there, toured a kibbutz and said, boy, this is what it's supposed to be like?
My wife's grandfather came from Russia in 1917 and helped found the second kibbutz in Israel.
It was the utopia the Soviet Union was looking for, and they had it in the kibbutz system in Israel.
Yeah, and they both collapsed.
So I guess there's a lesson right there. I'm speaking with Martin Fletcher, and Martin is 30 years a correspondent for NBC News, reporting from the Middle East, and his book is Walking Israel, the story of his two-week hike from the top to the bottom of Israel along the Mediterranean coastline. Martin, I'm just fascinated by the sort of finale of your walk. You came finally to the south edge of Israel, to the border of Gaza, and you stood there under those surveillance zeppelins, looking across the barricades at the haze of Gaza City. Tell me what you thought when you were there, and what did you hope?
What I thought was, to be honest with you, thank God I reached the end of this walk. I want to go home. That's actually what I was thinking. But at the same time, I've been so many times into Gaza, and it was very interesting to see it from that perspective on the beach, you know, where it's so beautiful. It's an abandoned, long, sandy, beautiful beach that people don't use because it's a little bit too dangerous, a little bit too close to the border. And I was just thinking of the contrast between the beauty of the place and the menace of the place as well. And actually, when I started to take photographs, within minutes, I was surrounded by Israeli soldiers who deleted the pictures from my camera, which was a reminder that, beautiful as it is, it's a very sensitive place. And as I stood there, I realized, after 30 to 35 years of reporting from Israel on one level, now, after only 2 weeks walking and talking to people, I was reaching another level of understanding of the place that made me love the place even more. And I couldn't wait to get back and go meet all those people again and get further into the, I guess, the fabric, the real context of the mosaic of what Israel really is. Not just a country at war, but a wonderful place struggling with the issues of survival and what kind of country it would be.
Martin Fletcher, author of Walking Israel, thank you so much for taking us to Israel and giving us a better understanding.
Thanks. Thanks very much, Rick.
Shalom.
Yeah, shalom, shalom, Rick.
Arezeinu haktantone, lanetzach erastich, chayai, chayai, la'ad arezeinu.
You don't have to write for a newspaper or be a TV reporter to get up close to another culture and its people. Willie Weir has found that traveling on a bicycle is a great way to slow down and get acquainted with our world. And it can result in some amusing stories. Willie was our first guest on Travel with Rick Steves when we started the program back in 2005. And he joins us from time to time to tell us about his latest adventures. We've asked him to share more of his travel tales with us as a sort of postcard from the road, from his adventures on two wheels.
I call it the gamble. Purposefully aiming to be in between guaranteed lodging at around sunset. You know, for as much as I like the comfort and affordability of guest houses in Thailand, when you pay for lodging, your relationship is client first and guest second. When you carry a tent on a bicycle journey, all you truly need is a 4x6 foot patch of flat ground. Kat and I began looking for that flat patch soon after we were passed by a speeding Toyota pickup with an elephant in the back, our first double take in Thailand. Our "what was that about" reaction was soon answered by another speeding truck filled with teak logs, tree poachers. The small secondary road wound through the forest and farmland, a mixture of bamboo, rice fields, and second-growth teak. The sun was low and the light was approaching the level when mosquitoes rise to feast on those without lodging. We came to the edge of this small village. Most parcels were fenced off and our options, well, they were running out. We passed this couple standing outside their home, and the woman smiled at us. Next door was a tamarind tree orchard. We stopped and we asked if we could pitch our tent under the trees. They indicated that the land wasn't theirs, but belonged to this old man next door. He was thin and slightly hunched over, and he was blind in one eye. He had just arrived home and parked his bike around the back of the simple wooden house. He showed us where we could pitch our tent and led us through the house to the bath and the toilet where we bathed using a bucket. We crawled into our tent and wondered if we'd seen the last of him. But the smell of smoke and the glow of fire drew us out. He was seated outside on a wooden bench next to a table, and his wife sat nearby in a stool. A couple of boys showed up, fascinated with our bicycles, and then the neighbors dropped by. The old man sat down on the bench, and then he sat down right next to me. His breath was sweet and smelled of sticky rice. He talked to me, although I did not understand a word, and he felt my arms in a gentle manner, like someone inspecting a prized horse. And then he put his strong hand on my shoulder, and he massaged it. I was taken aback, for that is the exact way my father touches me when I come home to visit. When I was in high school, it made me uncomfortable. Dad, that's just weird. And later I tolerated it. But looking at this stranger's face in this small village in Thailand, I felt embraced without being hugged. I felt, for lack of better words, in touch. We sat out by the fire for hours. We sang a bit, coaxed on by a neighbor who was on her second bottle of Thai whiskey. She sang a chorus of what sounded like an old folk song. I sang a chorus from the musical The Fantastics, and she laughed after every phrase, which made everybody else laugh, including me. Laughter is the perfect universal language. I don't think we speak it often enough. A young girl dropped by, and she spoke some English, and we learned that our hosts were childless and had lived in the village all their lives. After many attempts, we finally understood the old man's joke that if I relieved myself during the night, his tamarinds would be that much sweeter. The fire finally died, the neighbors said their goodbyes, and Kat and I retired to our tent. The next morning, we rose with the sun. The old man greeted us and gave us a bag of freshly cooked sticky rice. And then he gave me a hug, the first I'd received in Thailand. I looked at that old man. I didn't even know his name. We didn't share a language. We barely had anything close to what you'd call a conversation. Yet in those brief moments around the fire, I came to understand my own father's touch. And an old man, well, he got to feel what it was like to have a son.
ส่งครานเชียงใหม่นั้นตรึงตราใจฉันมันหนุ่มสาวช่างสุขสันต์เขาเพลิดเพลินทั้งวันรดน้ำให้กันฉันเที่ยวดูเจอสาวหนึ่งช่างงามสวยวิไลผมสบายแพรสีชมพูเป็นเทพีที่ฉันฟอง
Travel with Rick Steves is produced by Tim Tatton with Sarah McCormick at Europe Through the Back Door in Edmonds, Washington. Thanks to our colleagues at the Radio Foundation in New York for their production help today. We also get technical help from Andrew Wakeling and Kate Mulhern Graham. Our theme music is by Jerry Frank. You can chat with Rick and his guests. Simply add your email address to the Sign Me Up link, and that's in the radio section of our website. That way we can notify you of our next recording sessions and topics. You'll find many interviews from past editions of the show arranged by the countries we discuss, plus Rick's European walking tours. They're available to download your portable player or smartphone. Look for the Rick Steves Audio Europe links on the front page of our website at ricksteves.com. And join us again next week for more Travel with Rick Steves.